Poetry on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, the first of two episodes in conversation with Cassandra Atherton and Paul Hetherington about how they collaborate in writing poetry, in anthology editing, and in critical writing about poetry. Plus, the Rhyming Bugle, poetry news from around the region. I'm Kimberly K. Williams. Paul Hetherington, who recently retired as the head of the University of Canberra's International Poetry Studies Institute, has published 17 collections of poetry, including prose poetry. He refers to Melbourne-based Cassandra Atherton as, quote, probably Australia's best prose poet, end quote. She has authored and edited more than 30 critical and creative books. Together, Cassandra Atherton and Paul Hetherington have published collaborative poetry, as well as an anthology of Australian prose poetry, A Strange Magic, Australian Prose Poetry from Melbourne University Press in 2020, and, in the same year, one of the world's first extensive academic studies of the form, Prose Poetry in Introduction from Princeton University Press. Cassandra Atherton and Paul Hetherington talked about some of those activities when they came recently to the Art Sound Studios. But let's begin each of our two episodes with a prose poem sequence that illustrates their collaborative work. Here's Eggs after Joe Brainard. We'll find out later why it's all about, well, eggs.
Eggs after Joe Brainard. Once I ordered poached eggs for breakfast at New York's Malibu Diner, and they gave me two eggs in a cup with no toast. I ate them with a fork, dangling bits of undercooked white.
Once you stole my egg prose poem, you abseiled it over a coffee cup and won a prize for it.
Once I fed plums to your hens, but the broody one looked sideways as if it were an impossibly misshapen purple egg.
Once you told me our love was an egg and our vowels a sticky mess. But the next day, you cooked me two perfect hard-boiled ovoids.
Once we swallowed prairie oysters, fondly remembering Sally Bowles in Cabaret.
Once you told me you were an identical twin, and I imagined your mother's egg splitting in half and your face smiling out from the left half circle.
Once I bought wine simply because it said, may contain traces of egg.
Once I downloaded the app to track my ovulation, but I decided to go on a pill instead, each pill an undeveloped ovum.
Once you said your thoughts were scrambled, but soon produced ideas like glistening poached whites.
Once a newspaper article stated that someone had fried an egg on railway tracks. Did the train bisect it perfectly like a razor blade, or did the vibrations scramble it into a yellow and white stickiness?
Once I saved up my cream eggs at Easter, but months later when I peeled back their foil coverings, their centres were hard-boiled caramel.
Once I read you the line from Macbeth about Lady Macduff's son being an egg, and you took it personally.
Once you pushed back your plate of spaghetti in Lygon Street, telling me you could never eat spaghetti unless it was in a special Roman restaurant. You took me there and smugly held up your plate of pasta smothered in golden yolks.
Once you coddled me like an egg, such low heat and lazy caresses.
Once during water restrictions, I used the egg timer in the shower. I reset it three times before deciding I'd been properly cooked.
Once I made Welsh rarebit with self-raising flour and three eggs, and it puffed up like Hokusai's The Great Wave of Kanagawa.
Once the recipe said not to eat the batter because it contained raw eggs, but I ate a big spoonful, the traces of yolk like a gustery golden ore.
Once you kissed me so tenderly, your lips were like the softest yellow centre. We remembered the avocado and poached egg breakfast at the old paper shop deli.
Once you said my poems were like eggs, and I dreamed of sitting on each of them for three long weeks.
Once you said that our intimacy was a half-cooked egg white, but I refused to follow your meaning.
How did Cassandra Atherton and Paul Hetherington come to collaborate in various walks of poetic life?
Well, I was the person who said I'd never collaborate with anyone. Like, I had had bad experiences in the past. You know, the ones where you do all the work and somebody else gets half of the credit for your work, or it was very difficult to get people together, so it never quite got off the ground. So I decided I was a bit of a lone wolf and I'd just go at it alone. Until I met you at one of the conferences, I think, and we had a discussion about prose poetry. I think I'd read some prose poetry. And I remember you asked that magical question, which is there any kind of scholarship on prose poetry? What's the state of prose poetry in Australia? And that kicked us off into some fantastic conversations that ended up with you saying, let's write a paper. I think that's the first thing we did.
Yeah, I mean, I was not writing prose poetry when I first met Cassandra, and not conscious of being all that interested in it either. But once we got into this conversation, I'd assumed that prose poetry, at least internationally, would have had a lot of scholarship around it, and that there would be many, many books and articles. And Cassandra, I actually didn't really quite believe Cassandra when she told me that there hadn't been much. And anyway, we had a fascinating conversation. I started writing prose poetry, partly because of Cassandra's sort of example, really, because she is probably Australia's best prose poet, I think, anyway. And I got really interested in the form, but I also, this discussion around, you know, scholarship led me to think, well, if there isn't that much scholarship, I'd like to think about it through scholarship as well as through writing it. And we had the discussion led to, you know, the sort of outcome, what can we do? Can we start a project? And I'm a bit of an enthusiast, I certainly was in those days, for, you know, starting new things and trying things out. And we came up with the project that eventually led to an article being published in the New Writing Journal in the UK, and we've never looked back, really.
No, so we started with scholarship. Maybe that's a nice little step, because I think sometimes poetry can be so personal, whereas scholarship has elements of things that are personal, but because it's sort of criticism and you're talking about where your ideas fit in with other people's, it doesn't seem quite so so related to yourself and you putting yourself on the line. I remember being really nervous when we started writing the first article, having someone read my work and wondering if it sort of fitted in the way that you know, you wanted it to fit with what you'd written. So there was a lot of back and forth and a lot of nervousness. Now I don't even care. I'm just like, I slap some like bullet points and I'm like, I'm sorry, I got to the conclusion and I just like my brain died. You'll have to fix that bit.
How long has it been that you've been working together that you could reach that point?
Yeah, like it was a fair while. There's been blood, sweat and tears to get to that point. I think it's called that book, The Prose Poetry and Introduction. That's where I think the point at which we relaxed and knew one another's strengths and weaknesses and we could work to those really well, I think. So
I think we kind of started in about 2015. I mean, the conversation was like first conversation, but perhaps a little earlier. But I think the first article might have been published in 2016. And we've published now more than 30 scholarly articles together, plus the book on prose poetry.
Right. And then there's also the Australian prose poetry anthology.
Yeah.
Once we got interested in prose poetry in terms of writing about it in scholarly terms, because Cassandra had been writing a lot of prose poetry, but hadn't actually written articles about it.
No.
I hadn't been writing prose poetry and I hadn't been even really thinking about it. Once we got involved, I mean, I became absolutely absorbed in it, and Cassandra already was absorbed in the form, and the scholarship extended outwards. And once we'd written some articles, we actually thought, well, there isn't the kind of book out there, an introductory book that's also really sophisticated and surveys the field, you know, actually tries to be up to date with contemporary international prose poetry. And it was a big ask. It was a huge undertaking. But the great thing was that Cassandra thought of approaching Princeton University Press, which was, in a sense, the dream publisher.
Yeah.
And to my absolute surprise, they wanted to publish the book.
And then, what sparked from that was the question about Australian prose poetry and wanting to put an anthology together, because we felt there was this huge tradition that was sort of unacknowledged, especially some of the women early on in the prose poetry tradition in Australia. So that's when we did a call, but we thought we weren't getting the very best in the call for prose poems. So then we scoured libraries just before the pandemic, I think that happened.
We were very lucky in terms of timing because we... I've obviously I can access the National Library here, which has got a great collection of Australian poetry. But we also went to various libraries in Monash and so on in Melbourne.
The Bellew, yeah.
And to find out what we could see, not only in the books, but in the special collections. Mm. And we didn't publish much material from that, but that gave us a wonderful sense of context. Like when so-called prose pieces, or they're called various different things, started to emerge in some of the little magazines, particularly in the 70s in Australia. And we photocopied quite a lot of that. And also that led to a kind of discussion about what this anthology would be. And, you know, we wanted it to be, there had been a little anthology previously, but basically no attempt to comprehensively survey and understand what the prose poetry tradition in this country was. And it was a fantastic journey. It was a very lengthy journey because the call for poems meant that we went through hundreds of poems which were submitted to us. And then we did all our own research. And we really did want to find every significant prose poetry that had been published in the country now and to choose from those. Maybe we didn't find everyone, but we found a very great number of them.
Right. It's a substantial book, right? It's University of Melbourne Press.
Yeah, yeah.
And so and that came out the same year or within so many months of the Princeton one, right?
It did.
So that's... It was a big year.
Well, partly we finished the Princeton book and then the rights, getting rights for all of the poems that we quoted in there was a very long process. It was close to 6 to 9 months, I think. So we have so many quotations. I think someone's even said they love it because not only is it a book of scholarship, but it's like a mini anthology of some great, you know, international prose poetry. But it did take a long time to track things down. I remember asking my husband, because he's quite good at internet searching, and he tracked one prose poet down via her husband who played in a golf club, and he had the newsletter in America from the golf club, and he contacted the golf club and we got to her that way. So, and she said, "How on earth did you find me?" And I'm like, wow. With some detective work. Because, you know, we probably naively wrote the book using the examples that we wanted to use for various techniques and ideas that we were talking about. And then, of course, we sat down to get the rights. And a lot of people do it the other way around. They sort of ask people they know if they can use quotes from their poetry. And so they've set it out before they really start writing a chapter. But we did it the other way, which required lengthy periods of trying to get in contact with people.
Yeah, I mean, it was Cassandra did the majority of that rights work, which was absolutely fantastic, particularly from my point of view. but seriously, it was we were kind of almost sort of idealistic. We wanted to every prose poetry example which we wanted to use in a particular chapter, because the chapters focus on different things, we included. And then that search for rights was amazing. And actually, the search for rights for the anthology of Australian prose poetry was nowhere near as complex, but it was still required a lot of sort of digging around. And there was one poet, a woman poet, who hadn't published for a long, long time and was kind of untraceable. And in the end, I found her on Facebook because I looked up a name, and there are a number of people on Facebook with a name. And I went through each of the sort of profile pics, and there was one profile pic that had a family, and there was this son, I think, in the family that looked very like an early picture of her when she had this, her one and only book published, which we'd got this prose poem from. So I wrote to her through Facebook and said, "I think you could be the person." And she said, "Yes, I am. How did you know?" And I said, can we use your poem? And she said, "I don't write anymore, but yes." And we were so thrilled. Those sorts of kind of finding out moments where you meet the person or find the person or winkle something out of a literary agent. And Cassandra, how long did one of those literary agents take us for the Princeton book? It was about 10 months or something, wasn't
it? We had to ring at 3 o'clock in the morning. They just weren't answering anything at all. And it was, they kept saying that it was in train, but it never was. And the people would change. And then it was always surprising. So collaboration is interesting from this point of view too, because you collect all these people who are now excited that you want to publish a part of their poem in a book. And so that's lovely, because you start having these kind of online, I guess, friendships, mm-hmm. you know, with other poets. But you also find out the poets that charge a ridiculous amount for their poems.
With our collaborations, we don't sort of have a kind of any kind of spreadsheet where we work out who's doing what. We just do what each of us is capable of doing at any given time or volunteers to do. And that's not just with permissions and so on, it's with writing or editing. For example, the Anthology of Australian Poets Poetry happened to be COVID, so I was sitting there at home. I was working, but I had a little couple of months where I didn't have too many commitments, And I just went through that anthology. Cassandra done a huge amount of work on it already. I'd done a bit. I went through that, you know, week after week, chasing quite a lot of stuff, rereading things. If you take it really seriously and you want it to be kind of as definitive as you can get it, it is a lot of work. And the great thing about the collaboration that Cassandra and I have, from at least from my point of view, is that, you know, we just share it in a kind of fluid way. It's like a kind of, it's almost sort of like a intellectual dance. You know, we don't have a way of quantifying it. We just move in and out of different kinds of tasks and work as the opportunity arises. We're both very keen. We both like working hard. So we just do it in that way. And it's a great way of working, because it means that we can fit our lives and our work around our collaboration, or our collaboration around our lives and work. It's a fluid process. Right. And I love that aspect of good collaboration.
There are things I hate doing that he doesn't mind doing, and vice versa. So I hate proofreading. And I know every time he'll send me the article when it's, you know, in its final stages to read, and he says, make sure you proof that. And I think, oh, do I need to? Because he will have done it 42 times already. And I think, oh, no, I better do this. And then I love it if I find something, because it's proof I read it. And occasionally you've given me a little test here and there, because you know that I probably don't proof properly. But that's good, because he gives that special attention, because I'm not as strong a proofreader. But then there are other things, like I'm pretty good at doing research on certain topics. And so I like the fact that I can say, oh, look, I've read these four things, and these are the ideas, and he'll say, send me the articles and we'll have a discussion about it. But yeah, we know the things that we're good at and the things that other people can take the lead with, I guess.
Yeah.
How is it doing this together as opposed to how you imagine it might be individually?
Well, there's lots of things. I mean, from a really boring point of view, you can get a lot more done. There's two of you. Both of us are professors, and so we've got a lot of other administrative work and work in the sort of service area, as well as some teaching. So it's great to be able to get twice as many things out, which is really what they recommend to definitely my university. But I guess more than that, it's about having someone to constantly talk to about the curious ideas you have about a form, for example. And I don't think either of us would have come to the same conclusions and the same arguments on our own for the Princeton book that we did together. So, I mean, we had so many arguments. I mean, great arguments, but, you know, nevertheless, fairly heated ones at times. There were tears, come on, from both sides, I think, at various points. So I think that it's stronger because you just have two kind of crazy minds coming together and sharing ideas and taking the best of that. Although we have argued about the fact that I think now our intellectual property is so, you know, entwined, that it's very difficult for one of us to do something in the prose poetry world without the other, or at least talking to the other person about it.
I think that's true.
Because we don't, if you open that book, I can tell you which chapter I might have started, but we have edited it and crossed it over and done so many things that it's actually not, you can't define, I think, which chapters we took the leads on and what they've ended up as.
Because
we've
melded.
It has. And that's how I feel about our thoughts on it too.
Yeah, I mean, actually, in terms of quality of writing, particularly with the Princeton book on prose poetry, you know, we took initial responsibility for five chapters each, And for example, the chapter on women Cassandra drafted initially, and a chapter on sort of protosorial kind of issues Cassandra drafted initially, and so on. And I drafted, so it's five each. But yeah, Cassandra's right. By the time we finished, and when we got a bit sick of any particular iteration of a chapter, we'd hand it back, and in some cases quite a lot of work would be done by the other person or additions. Those chapters became kind of fused in terms of thinking, and you know, we're pretty, both pretty direct people, so if one of us didn't like an idea or didn't think it was fleshed out enough, or thought the ideas weren't expressed clearly enough, or there weren't enough examples, we said those things to each other constantly, and then obviously often took responsibility for doing something about what we perceived to be an issue. And that's a wonderful, not just a to and fro, but a kind of process of aggregation where you begin to turn ideas from, say, the quality they might have in an academic article of, say, 5,000 words into something much more dense and sort of argued through and hopefully more sophisticated in a 10,000 word chapter, which roughly what each of those chapters are. And it's a fantastic journey because the argumentativeness is part of finding something out that is difficult. You know, some of these ideas are difficult ideas. Prose poetry, for example, no one had been prepared to define or try to take on, you know, the challenge of saying what prose poetry actually is, should be, might be, particularly in the early part of the 21st century. And, you know, we really wanted to tackle that head on.
It's true. I think it might have been around 2016, 2017, I was teaching a prose poetry and flash fiction class in the U.S., and there was no text to draw on.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the reasons Princeton agreed, because they said, you know, there's a lot of courses going on, but not a lot of books attached to those courses. So that was lucky for us too. And I mean, look, honestly, as I said before, I don't think I would have written the book. I wasn't into prose poetry scholarship. I was writing a lot of prose poetry, but I wasn't really thinking about, I was writing scholarship on the atomic bomb. I had other areas I was interested in. So without that initial conversation. And what I will say is the one thing that has been really helpful is we both have a similar writing style. I think it can be really difficult to collaborate if your writing styles are really different from one another. And we were just sort of lucky. I mean, you get a bit pompous sometimes, but I kind of reel that back in a little
bit. I think a bit of gravitas is good.
So could we shift just to talking then about your own prose poems and how your collaborations inform those?
I don't know. I think there was a bit of a two-step process. So the process that we currently engage with when we write prose poems is exciting for me because we write the same prose poem together. So I think there's another kind of way of collaborating which happens when you ask a whole lot of people to contribute to a particular idea or theme and you publish those poems together, or someone writes the first part of a book on a theme and another person writes the second. But we have got to the point where we write the same poem together. So recently in a cafe, like, we'd get a notebook and write a few lines and then push the notebook across and the other person would drink their coffee and really try to write a prose poem together.
Wow.
And you normally, to make that task successful, you need a really delicious and large piece of cake.
Do eat a lot of cake.
I imagine.
It's actually great because, you know, we obviously are continuing to write our own creative works separately as well. We sometimes share those in a sort of editorial way, but they're our separate works. And the sort of the collaborative joint writing is really exciting because obviously, you know, as you're passing this note back and forth, you're reading and, you know, accumulating text which increasingly is nothing that either of you would write by yourself.
Right.
It's got its own kind of dynamic and momentum, and we do that just trying to create something that is of the moment and that follows an idea and pursues it. And then obviously, you know, some things work better than others, but someone will take the notebook or a photograph of the pages away and type them up, and then we'll continue to work on them. But and we might, each of us might do bits of editing, but that's still very much a back and forth process of discussion. So a lot of that editing is done in track changes, and then the other person might look at them and then decide yes or no and do their own track changes. So the key, one of the keys for me is in that process is that it continues to be a sharing process right through to the end, and also that, you know, I often think it's working if it doesn't sound like me. You know, it might, bits of it might sound like me, it might sound a bit like me, but, you know, I think it's really important if you're doing this kind of collaborative work that you're not trying to somehow compel the process to sound like, or either of the people trying to compel the process to sound like the way they would normally write.
Right.
There's a kind of a third person, and that's a collaborative entity, the collaborative persona.
I do know that if I write a couple of lines of a poem and push it across the table, I sort of can't help but have an expectation of what I meant by those lines and some kind of idea of where it's going to lead. But inordinately, he takes it somewhere entirely different. And then I had to get used to being like, no, it was supposed to say, you know, this was supposed to happen. And then you realize it's opened up into something, you know, far more interesting.
Next, Cassandra Atherton and Paul Hetherington spoke about the prose poem sequence we heard at the start of this episode, Eggs After Joe Brainard. It was nominated for a Pushcart Prize and was about eggs. Why?
Because we both love eggs. Maybe we were eating eggs the day we wrote that. I don't know.
I can't remember, but certainly, we both really love eggs. One of the things about collaboration is if you find little points of connection and sometimes of disconnection as well, which can be equally sort of stimulating in different ways, but like just a simple thing like the fact you both like eating eggs can lead to a prose poem, which is not just about any eggs at all. It's about a whole lot of things.
It's in Arriving at a Shoreline. It's the anthology for Great Weather for Media. It did partly also come from the fact that I did write an egg poem on my own, and I sent it to you, I think, and
that's
then
right.
You wrote a better egg poem, submit it for a competition, and won. And that's the stolen egg poem.
That was fun. I enjoyed that. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I enjoy about the creative stuff is that in terms of my own sort of separate prose poetry writing or other poetry that I'm writing, the collaborative writing gives a way of thinking about topics and ideas, which sometimes do come back. I mean, joking aside about sort of eggs and stolen eggs and so on, they do come back into a sort of a solitary writing process as well. So it's like, I think the solitary writing can sometimes feed the collaborative process, but also it can be the other way around. You know, it can be really quite generative and stimulating way of just thinking about how you might pursue your own work.
We learn from one another the things we're good at and start to experiment with our own, you know, solo kind of poetry as well.
Today's Poetry on the Radio has been the first of two episodes about Cassandra Atherton and Paul Hetherington's collaborations in the writing of poetry and poetry criticism. Join us next week for more of the discussion. I'm Kimberly K. Williams.
The Rhyming Bugle. On Monday, July 15 at Smith's Alternative at 7 p.m, Recent Work Reading presents K.A. Nelson. She'll debut her second collection of poems, Meaty Bones, and Martin Dolan. He will introduce his fourth poetry book, On the Record. The submission deadline for entries to the University of Canberra Vice Chancellor's International Poetry Prize has been extended to July 17. That's tomorrow. Search online for University of Canberra Vice Chancellor's International Poetry Prize 2023. This month's reading at Manning Clark House on Thursday, July 27 at 7 p.m. will present three readers. Leslie Lebkowitz's fifth book, Mountain Line, was published by Pitt Street Poetry in 2019. She has recently edited an anthology of Australian poems about birds with Penelope Leyland. Kathy Kittaway has published seven poetry collections, five anthologies, a children's picture book, and a four-part radio documentary. Plus, all the way from Castlemaine, Victoria, Ross Donlan. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded Ngunnawal country in the studios of Art Sound FM and airs Sundays at 4:30pm and at 10:30pm on Mondays and online at artsound.fm. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produce the program with me, Peter Monahan. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. The music on today's program is from Gabriella Smart's album Chinese Whispers. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregorio Paniagua and the Atria Musica de Madrid.